transgressing the taboo, banning social science experiments in the real world, uncommitted and personally authorized liminal experimentation of this kind has traditionally been out of bounds for employees of rational and ethical institutions such as universities, as undesirable since it brings into question the absolute values they are founded on. I was walking on eggshells, but managed in my liminal and absurd-appearing role as wizard to avoid being stopped on the grounds of illegality, insanity, or immorality. Since I began my experiments, there has been rapid growth in puritanical managerialism, which is increasingly monetized and less rational or ethical. It is certainly not beautiful, nor therapeutic, and severely punishes individual initiative. As a consequence, my symbolic interaction in all fields has been increasingly limited. I'm still hoping that an approach to academics with an understanding of process theory will enable me to sum up and place my results with the academic community to guide others and to encourage them to continue my great work. It might help academics to understand what I am doing if I compare these experiments of mine with the first proto-scientific experiments, including thought experiments, conducted between the 9th and 13th centuries by the sponsored Jewish, Christian, and Muslim intellectuals in the House of Wisdom in Baghdad under the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphates. Teams of scholars had already set about translating learning from the Greek, Hellenistic, Indian, and Chinese manuscripts the Muslims had come across as their empire suddenly expanded. This was facilitated by using the new medium of paper invented by the Chinese for their writing and illustrations. Their synthesis of Hindu and Arabic numerals led to great advances in mathematics, and their experiments in so many fields, including optics, chemistry, physiology, medicine, and mechanics, provided the foundations of the scientific revolution almost 1,000 years later. This encounter by European intellectuals with these scientific and philosophical writings followed the establishment of the Kingdom of the Normans in Palermo, the Crusade in Palestine, and the long period of the Reconquest in Spain, and inspired the independent magicians who appeared during the Renaissance. They incorporated them into their theories and their radical new experiments, led eventually to the invention of modern science by the mechanistic branch of the magicians. The mechanists achieved this by splitting completely from their colleagues, like Paracelsus and Kepler, who maintained the connection between the ethical metaphysics of God's love and the Neoplatonic strain to beauty. They actively persecuted magicians like these during the 17th century, and their importance to the development of human consciousness has been ignored, even deliberately demonized ever since. Following Galileo's example, the mechanists concentrated on the provision of useful technological truths about kinematics for the rising class of manufacturers, entrepreneurs, and traveling traders. Reason and morality were separated, with only moral philosophy attempting unsuccessfully to bridge an unbridgeable gap. Enlightenment was characterized by their conceptual separation of godlike subjective observers from soulless objective matter, which they manipulated for utilitarian reasons. This was made possible by Pythagorean idealism, which René Descartes made reputable by his commitment to God, whom he believed was essentially a mathematician like himself. Only through ecstatic surrender to his mathematician God could he detach himself from corporeal embodiment in the material world to become an objective observer. The Pythagorean belief that mathematics is so pure that it must be located outside the universe, although nonsensical and falsified mathematics by Gödel, has continued into the modern period with disastrous consequences for any internal, consistent, and inclusive cosmology. Those who still claim to be objective observers are either liars, fools, or insane. Responsible personal agency. The impossible, irrational, irresponsible, and immoral slaves who have sold their souls to become part of the blob can never exercise true personal agency and can never afford to doubt that they are in possession of the absolute truth and must force this truth on everyone else. I can persuade readers not trapped in the blob to follow my arguments. when opposing the monster, I have discarded the we masks that often hide our less honourable intentions and enable us to avoid personal responsibility. To be realistic, I admit that I am, like everyone else, unavoidably a we as a member of a collectivity, distinguished from others, whether it be organic versus inorganic, male versus female, teachers versus student, British crown subject versus American Republican citizen, Christian versus Muslim, and so on. However, in 1968, there came a point in my life where I could only say I concerning matters where I had identified problems and solutions but could find no one else prepared to act or speak out to the public about. I have never experimented with consciousness-raising drugs, but this was as near as I have come to an epiphany. Accidents of history. Although, like many others, I was socialized into becoming a young socialist through family upbringing and compulsory secular education, I was deconditioned by my experiences as a mad keen Boy Scout, RAF navigator, paper merchant representative in the City of London, long-time backpacker in the Balkans and Middle East, CEO of a major university-sponsored arts festival, and pioneer academic sociologist of religion. I'd already developed a deep responsiveness to creative play to become an innovative cultural administrator in two universities. By an accident of history, I was caught up as a child in the populist uprising in what was then the British Empire against both pro-Stalin socialists and pro-Hitler capitalists, when in 1939 the two dictators suddenly joined forces to enable the Nazis to attack and occupy Europe, with France unexpectedly collapsing in utter. Miraculously, British morale was revived and raised up to fever pitch, almost single-handed by Winston Churchill, an old-school Tory. Many intellectuals today are frightened at the prospect of a populist revival. Who would now judge the 1940 populist uprising in support of the British Christian imperial values threatened by an unprecedented brutal German National Socialist tyrant and the mutual temptation of another even more brutal International Socialist tyrant to be dangerously deluded or wicked? The class war replaces the class war. Cultural hegemony. As I already mentioned, I believe that the events that led to the independent emergence of the blob took place primarily in the 1960s and were focused in the suddenly expanded university social science departments of the time. The Marxist academics of the post-war Parisian deconstructionist school were still playing an important part in interpreting all cultural phenomenon as little more than what was for them meaningless power relationships. A check of the indices of their theoretical works reveals that the essential concept of social roles as the playful but fundamental action components of social systems had been completely eliminated in their puritanical reductionist writing. In spite of an abundance of unreadable jargon and neologisms, these career intellectuals, who were employed and financially rewarded by the state, were made into celebrities by the commercial media already embedded in the developing European blob. These celebrity academics were important in facilitating the managerial takeover of the professions that permitted the emergence of the all-power blob. At the same time, the hegemonic culture theory of the Marxist revisionist Antonio Gramsci was now becoming popular among social scientists. Without stating it explicitly, Gramsci assumed that institutionalized cultural values such as love and beauty and truth and virtue as rival human concerns to hierarchy of power had to be deconstructed as epiphenomenal, and only egalitarian power relationships were to be given any significance. As the first academic lecture in sociological theory in Australasia, 1965-6 and 1967, I was deeply concerned by the events taking place around me and elsewhere in the universities in England, Europe, and North America, seeing them undergoing rapid political and economic changes away from partly autonomous institutions previously idealized as communities of scholars. I started a playful university reform movement to oppose this drift away from communitas. Why me? The accepted belief of the most significant modern process thinkers is that the cosmos is a kind of giant evolving organism with its overall intentions, large unknowable to us, but moving towards increasing complexity. Human beings expressing through their culture values such as beauty, truth, and goodness are part of this process. The only explanation of my unique personal career, both within the academic community and in the world outside, that makes any sense of what has been happening around me since 1968 is that by designing and acting out new but coherent and responsible roles in a spirit of fun, without consciously intending it, I have somehow been formed by the cosmos itself to becoming the dialectical opposite and leading opponent of the enemy of truth, beauty and goodness, the blob. Hence the title of this essay. It really is the blob and I. Are there any other claimants to that title? This is truly disconcerting to me and my friends. This burden carries not only to rationally absurd, but since I'm not a megalomaniac, it is very hard for me to shoulder, as I take no pleasure in leadership roles, preferring to teach by setting an example or by setting up new structures and then letting them run themselves. But if it's fun and avoids cognitive dissonance, I'll do it.